sets us up to talk about spirits, ghosts, poltergeists, specters, creatures, monsters, crypto, animals, aliens, call them what you will. Is there a connection between all of them? You know, I get emails and calls and texts from people who are having issues in their house. And I mean the kind of issues we're talking about tonight. Spirits, specters, unwanted intruders, and they ask me what can they do, and I have to tell them, I'm sorry, I'm a reporter. Sometimes I host a radio show. I have no idea how to deal with that kind of stuff. But our guests tonight have developed some protocols and rules and suggestions for how people can handle it, how investigators can handle it, and we're going to be talking with Stephen Mira and Barry Fitzgerald about some of the specific suggestions in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Steve Mira, I was mentioning during the break about these calls and messages I get on occasion where people have what sounds like a poltergeist, some kind of a something loose in their home that's driving them crazy, and they ask for advice. I have no idea what to tell them. You've worked out some protocols, as you mentioned, on how to deal with that. Are these designed for investigators and professionals or for regular people that can deal with it on their own?
Well, actually, it's both, George. I mean, obviously, there are a number of investigators which have had experiences by immersing themselves within this subject on a regular basis. I can certainly vouch for that, as can Barry. And on many occasions, one of the what Barry has mentioned earlier is about this key to the iron. It's certainly been beneficial throughout the centuries. It seems to be beneficial within the modern day as well. We've utilized aspects of placing iron around certain areas where effective phenomena, where a phenomenon has been taking place, and does seem to be a deterrent. We know through ancient times that the people were placing iron around their homes when paranormal disturbances were happening. For instance, the iron horseshoe was nothing really about luck. It was basically because it was made of iron. And placing iron under beds, iron bars across cribs, as Barry's mentioned, to stop the fairies, should we say, abducting children from their cribs in hundreds of years ago. The aspect of farmers banging iron rods into the grounds to try and deter their animals from being taken or mutilated. The same applies in the paranormal field, or when people have placed iron nails around their bedrooms to ward off paranormal phenomena. In medieval times, it was considered to an important issue to circumnavigate the churches and cathedrals with iron wrought gates and fencing to divide.
Is that what the horseshoe is? Is that where a horseshoe comes from?
Yeah.
Yes.
The horseshoe is because it was made of iron. It was handy to have. It was made from iron. People place that around their homes, above the doors, to ward away bad spirits. This connection with this deterrent of iron seems to be even in modern day. We've dealt with a number of people who claim to have been having experiences, be it the paranormal, be it the ufological. And in some cases, some people who claim to be alien abductees, we've suggested for them to wear iron. And they seem to have had their experiences have certainly diminished somewhat. And it does seem to be evident that there is some form of deterrent because of iron. Now, we're currently researching at this moment in time the resonant frequency of iron under natural UV light. We're trying to figure out why this phenomenon, no matter what face or what mask it has this deterrent to iron. We will certainly suggest to people if they're having disturbances that is one of the things that can assist. Also, another thing that can assist is UV light. Flooding areas with UV light seems to be also help as a deterrent. So we really do require further research into this field at this moment.
Barry, I'd like to ask you, you've done a lot of these hauntings, ghost hunter episodes for television, and a lot of similar work off camera. Can you describe the kinds of experiences that some people have had, traumatic experiences? Because I'm sure you've been called into cases where the people feel like they're besieged. Can you describe sort of how it's affected families and what you were able to do for them?
Certainly, if
For some individuals, for some unlucky individuals, they've attracted the attention of things for no reason. You know, a lot of people would say, oh, well, it's this or it's that. Sometimes there can be no reason for this. You can just be down, you can be in the library, you can be in the local store. And sometimes you just attract something back to the house. But there are other aspects that we need to be careful of as well. And in particular, actually, to understand this particular phenomenon, we have to understand who we are as a people and how we have changed since the Middle Ages. You see, since the Middle Ages, we've started accumulating objects. And our attention has went from what was inside to what's outside. So now in the modern age, we've got people who absolutely love their homes. They dedicate their time, their everything, their essence to the object. And when it comes time for them to leave, they don't, because they've created this noose that has held them here. So when you get this new couple that comes along and they say, oh, let's paint this wall, let's knock that one down, all hell begins to break loose, and they're wondering why. That's because of our attention to objects. And that in itself is why walking into an antique store can be quite an experience for people who are not sensitized to this particular essence, this signature energy, if you like. And there are ways in which we can detect that. But from the experiences that you're saying that people have had, there was one particular lady in the United States that I had gone out to, and she was being assaulted by what we would call, I suppose in the modern sense, would be recognized, Rosemary Allen Gailey there would recognize them as a djinn. And it was savage. And this thing was like the nighttime attacks, pretty much the same thing. Again, we're back to the same phenomenon, different mask. And she was being assaulted at night, sometimes even whenever she was just resting in her living room. And sexually assaulted as well. It was very intense. And there are others that can be that can have their homes even shaken in the foundations. That in itself can be a very unsettling experience for folks. I know that here back in Ireland, there have been occasions when phenomena has occurred in which the house itself has even cracked because of, you know, the connection to this older belief system of the fairy and things like that. Again, we're back to the same thing, same phenomena, different mask. And it's understanding what these things are. Is understanding what we've done to annoy this particular situation, because sometimes that can be the case, and there are other times in which we're inheriting this problem. The likes of George, you will recognise this in the ufology aspect, in that the likes of abductions, for instance, they run in the family line. This is something that goes back. The same thing can happen with hauntings. And this will follow back through the family line. Again, same phenomena, different mask. So all of this has to be understood to get to the crux of where we are. Now, when it comes to the likes of trying to deal with something that was done, say, 5 centuries ago, that is almost impossible. So we have to redirect our attention to getting back to getting these answers, and some of the answers can be quite difficult for folks to swallow, in that we have to take responsibility for what we're doing. And
what do you mean?
Sometimes when hauntings occur in a property, when it's allowed to go for such a period, what can happen is that we build a symbiotic relationship with this particular thing. And no matter who comes in to get rid of this particular entity, whatever it's doing, if the symbiotic relationship is not dealt with, and this is going to have to be something that the person deals with, if it's not dealt with, that the person who came in to deal with that particular haunting could be at the bottom gate after it's over, and that entity will be back because the people have not let go. And that is an aspect in which needs to be dealt with, and that is a bitter pill for folks to swallow as well. There's a certain amount of responsibility in which we have to accept for this phenomenon as well.
Sounds like you're walking right up to the edge of saying you've got cases where you haven't been able to help them because the people wouldn't help themselves, that whatever it is, it's still there.
I've been there, and I have lost one particular person springs to mind there, and it was a very bad case in the UK, and the same thing, the night attacks were happening, and I was called across, and I went, and I looked at the house, I dealt with the house. By the time I got back, this particular person's career had actually opened her to this particular phenomenon. By the time I got back, I got a phone call. And when I took the call, this person, I didn't even recognize the voice on the other end of the phone. Usually you get little bits of the signature of the accent of the voice, and you recognize the person on the other end of the phone without even looking at the caller ID. This person I did not recognize. I didn't know who it was. But she said, "When are you coming back?" And I said, "Well, you know, my work and everything else won't allow me to do that." And she said, "I understand that. But," and then she said something very unusual. She used her name and said that she really likes you. "When are you coming back?" And that's whenever I realized it was too late.
Oh.
and at that particular moment, the phone hung up. I got contacted by the family within a few hours, and she was found in a pool of blood at the front of the house. And there was nothing that could have been done apart from calling the authorities and saying, "Right, okay, this person needs to be brought in for her own safety." But it was too late at that particular stage.
Was it listed as a suicide?
No, she survived, thankfully. Oh. She survived. But we lost touch and everything else, and I have no idea what happened following that. And it was one that I was always very sorry for, and that I couldn't do anything for.
Steve, a lot of this sounds familiar to those who read Jacques Vallée. You know, him making the comparison long ago, as John Keel did, making the connection between what we call UFOs and aliens to the Fae, to fairies, goblins, trolls, stories of creatures of long ago, who some of which come in and abduct people or babies, things of that sort. The suggestion that there are different masks for the same phenomena, different names for the same phenomena. Do we know what the real mask is, what the real face is?
I don't believe we do. I think the amount of deception and hyper-basic phenomena this deception goes back thousands upon thousands of years, probably even predating historical documentation. One of the biggest problems that we have with trying to identify this phenomena, and the problem is that we never seem to get what is the real phenomenon. It always has to have an appearance of a different mask. And the way that people refer to these are different things. Cultures have referred to them as different things. One of the biggest problems for us that we were facing was the divide in these subjects. I think it's hindered. It's certainly hindered in regards to researching, for instance, ufology, because many years ago, there was these boxes created. These boxes say, for instance, the paranormal, the metaphysical, the supernatural, the ufological. Really, it's all one phenomena. I mean, anybody who really wants to fully investigate the UFO phenomena, you have to not have boxes. You cannot dismiss paranormal aspects of this. It is all one of the same phenomena. And this is what we were finding. So what we wanted to do is basically tear all those walls down, because we don't feel that we're going to ever get a proper grasp of this ufological phenomenon until that actually happens. Now, it's not the first time. We're not the first people who's touched on this. Jacques Vallée, amazing, the work that he did and continues to do so. And it was hammered home by himself as well. And he was absolutely right. But this phenomenon has many masks, has different names, and it's very, very deceptive. It's very intelligent. It's hyper-evasive. When we reference, look at documentation, official documentation, coming from establishments in the US, there was references years ago of the word WFM on many official documents. And we were curious, what was this WFM? Was it some type of project? Was it an establishment? It turned out that it was just a reference to weird freaking magic. Because at that time, I think they were trying to understand the physics of this ufology, the phenomenon. And I don't think that they've all, that they've got all the answers. I think that we have to look out of the physics that we've created and pour out some of this vast of knowledge and fill it up with new forms of physics, because I think that's the only way we're going to gain an understanding. And apart from this, it has the capability of being hyper-invasive. It has a conscious connection. There's so much evidence to support the conscious connection. We've tested this and found it ourselves in certain locations, that when we put the cameras away, then sometimes they'll appear. And that demonstrates that they know, they have been sent, and know what we actually are planning. Which is very interesting, because during the 1980s, there was a number of occasions when military pilots were given that shoot-down order on UFOs. And what was very interesting is that they reported that the objects were doing counter-maneuvers. You know, they were maneuvering in a countermeasure prior to weapon lock. And there's this, that they were measuring the intent of the pilot and what they were going to do. This we find in commonly, even in modern day, when we've been to locations and they seem to react towards being there. Sometimes they'll react to us by flashing lights and that sort of thing. Sometimes they won't even appear until we switch the cameras off. It would seem that there's enough evidence to support that if we're going to be dealing with some type of phenomenon like this, then it's very, very difficult. It's very difficult. We're under their terms. They're in control. They know our intent. It's very difficult to deceive them when they have information from the observer. So what we've got to do is try and tear all these walls down and look at this phenomenon as a whole. Because the subject, since the 1940s, some great investigation in the 1940s and 50s, but it would seem in modern day that the subject of ufology is gone a bit astray. There's certainly many colourful people and colourful stories in this subject now. It's become very entertainment factor. But what we're trying to do is get it back on track, trying to get the right people together to try and deliver some real answers as to the perplexing and complexity of this phenomenon, because I don't feel we are going to gain any further information. We're just going to add another stone to the mountain we've got with a photograph or a video. To get to the real crux of the matter, I think we've got to start looking at the picture as a whole.
You know, I think about the most famous current UFO case, or recent UFO case, one of the best documented of all time, as it turns out, the Tic Tac incident, the USS Nimitz from 2004, which has been the subject of considerable reportage over the last 15 months or so, since Lou Elizondo came forward, the New York Times broke a story, and the videos were released. And we know from the pilots involved in that incident, Commander Dave Fravor, that this UFO that he was trying to get close to, it disappeared basically and then appeared at his cap point, which is the spot at which he was supposed to go next. It anticipated where he was going to go, and it got there first. And how it did that, pretty strange. We'll be back with Steve Mera and Barry Fitzgerald in a moment. We're talking with Steve Mera and Barry Fitzgerald about investigations of the paranormal, the unknown, the supernatural, the connections that seem to run through all those different topics, different masks for the same phenomena. How can we tell what it really looks like? And can we determine where it comes from? It certainly doesn't sound like it's alien. It sounds like it's been here for an awfully long time. So is this home? We'll get into that and more on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Steve and Barry were just describing how elusive the phenomena can be. It's tough to identify what it really is. It's also tough to document what it is. It seems to be able to anticipate what's going to happen and to elude equipment, to elude cameras. This all sort of rings a bell with me, gentlemen, because of Skinwalker Ranch. You know, there was a team of scientists on there for many years, professional men with degrees, PhDs, lots of equipment, cameras all over the place. There were hundreds of incidents during their time on the property and before and after, but very little in the way of physical evidence and images, because you put a camera up in a place that had been active for several days with different kinds of activity, and it moves. And it seemed to be able to anticipate what they were going to do before they did it. And the same thing with the people who lived there and their neighbors and people in the larger area. Skinwalker Ranch is sort of a paranormal Disneyland. It has all the different kinds of supernatural activity that we've been talking about tonight in one place. And it changes forms, and it appears to different people, and to some people it doesn't appear at all. Barry, it sounds like it's right up your alley.
It is. Skinwalker Ranch actually sits on a magnetic anomaly. Now, that anomaly we can see from the satellite images stretches northwest and also southeast down through the areas there. But we're able to see the stronger areas of the anomaly, and that in itself can lead us to target specific areas. But you've got to understand that while you're in those target areas, there are things that we can do that will help us with the investigation itself, because it doesn't matter what particular type of equipment you bring here. There is one piece of equipment that we should be relying on when dealing with this phenomenon, which we're not, which is us. And you see, to understand this phenomenon, you have to understand and look at one of the largest purchases that we make over the course of our lives, which is a home, a house. 75% of real estate agents know this, 75% of homes are bought on feeling. Someone walks into a property and they go, oh, I like this. This is beautiful. It's feeling. What is that feeling? What is it that we're picking up from the environment, and how are we picking it up from the environment? And other instances, we could walk into a property and have nothing visually stimulating, and just like the last one, and yet we say, oh no, I don't like this, something isn't right. Again, we're back to the feeling. What is that feeling? And this is something we all possess. This gift of discernment, if you like, is something that we all possess. Now, to understand that, we started looking at tests that were being carried out within the laboratory, and with utilizing biofeedback devices, there was a test that was organized. 10 photographs were randomly selected by a computer. So there was no human intervention in this test whatsoever. And the pictures themselves were random positive things, like children laughing and kitty cats and everything else. And over the course of a period of time, when we continue to look at these randomly selected photographs, our skin resistance falls. We like what we see. But the computer would randomly select one image and throw it into the bunch of a traumatic car accident. And when we saw that coming, our skin resistance immediately rose. That is our key to understand the phenomena. That kickstarts our fight or flight. Now, from this particular instance, to understand our fight or flight, then we can now start moving into these particular areas and understand that voice that's in the back of our heads, that voice that whispers, this ain't right. And that particular phenomena can be checked. Now, from the fight or flight, when we find an instance in which we don't like, the adrenaline is released into the system, the hairs goes up in the back of our necks and up in our arms and everything else, our body is preparing itself to move. Now, it was interesting that during those particular tests that were carried in the lab, that what also was discovered is that as the test continued, milliseconds before the photograph was selected by the computer, we started reacting. In other words, we were predicting the future before it actually occurred. So our body started to react to this before the photograph was finally shown on screen. And this in itself can be improved greatly. getting back to this fight or flight, this particular aspect which we all possess, not a lot of people understand that that in today's society can be hushed. That can be quietened. You see, one of the our fight or flight's Achilles heel is refined sugar. And understanding that since the 1700s, for instance, our average consumption was around 4 pounds of sugar a year, just 4 bags. Accelerate ahead to the 1800s, we then start consuming 18 pounds of sugar. By the 1900s, that accelerated to 60 pounds. Now today, we're consuming over 180 pounds as each individual, 180 pounds of refined sugar a year. That has a negative effect on the fight or flight. Going into an investigation, for instance, beforehand, we see a lot of teams meeting at a, say, a fast food restaurant, and they have a bucket of soda drinks to consume before they head off. That is what we must not do. The refined sugar shuts down the body's fight or flight. That is the seat of our instinct. That will stop us and blind us from a situation that envelops, because when this appears, and this is what we see within the paranormal field as well as ufology, when they appear, and they can appear as children and everything else, we then react to what we see. We should be reacting to what we feel, and that voice comes from the heart. So nowadays we're in a situation where the road from the head to the heart is going to be its longest, because we need to understand what's going on. Steve and I and a group of others were in the desert in California last year, where this we knew that we were going into one of these key locations, and it took all of half an hour, and all of a sudden this light appeared above us, and the interaction was going back and forward for around 90 seconds. It was exceptionally intense. But immediately after that, I knew we had to leave. I was following my instinct, which I've honed now for quite some time. We needed to get out of there then. That experience was over. Now, one of the researchers that was there, I asked, what did you think of that? And she said, that was absolutely amazing. That was fantastic. And I said, what was your body doing? She said, what do you mean? I said, with the hair standing on the back of your neck and your arms. Yes. They said, that is a perfect example of what our ancestors called glamoring. What they were doing was hitting us with the visual stimulus in which we were entertaining that from the left-hand hemisphere of the brain. Our body instinctively was reacting to that with a softer voice that comes through the heart. We need to listen to the softer voice. Her body was telling her, this is not what it seems. We need to leave. So getting back to listen to that, we need to look at our diet from the modern sense. That is going to be the best piece of equipment that we have investigating this and going into this, understanding that there are side effects to investigating this phenomenon.
Steve, let me ask you this. You deal with skeptics on a regular basis. You joust with them. I don't know if it's as nasty as it is here. Likely is, but when you have a phenomena that is elusive by nature, that, as you said, can anticipate what's going to happen, can evade cameras and that sort of thing, equipment, it makes it tough to convince skeptics. It gives them a ready-made argument to say, aha, it's all a bunch of baloney. You can't get any visual evidence to prove that something is going on, right?
That's correct.
How do you deal with it?
It is. It's always been difficult. It's always been an uphill battle. But it's not something new. I mean, we know that information that came forward in the 1940s, excuse me, in regards to the Vril Society and their connection with conducting seances and allegedly talking with extraterrestrials. Excuse me. And the same process happened in 1998 in experiments throughout the UK known as the Skull Experiment, where the manifestation of an ET appeared on footage, on film, which they named Blue. And by all intents and purposes, it looked like a stereotypical grey with large black eyes. Again, not the first time. If we look at the research papers of Aleister Crowley, who was a practitioner of the dark arts, and in 1918 joined certain experiments, a manifestation of what could only be described as an extraterrestrial, which was referred to himself as Lamb, appeared. And apparently, it was the first time that he was really out of control, out of his situation. He was not comfortable having this experience, and certainly changed his path of research after having this experience in 1918. Tried further experiments in skull, during the skull experiments and seances, what we might refer to as a form of seance and ET channeling. It was realized very quickly that answers were being given prior to people even giving him the question. Again, there's this element of knowing, this observer connection, this connection consciously with what was going ahead. We also know that there are people which have been able to film the other side. We have Stella Lansing in 1961 on a cine film camera filming strange beings and UFOs. She had this impulse to suddenly jump up, go outside with this 10mm film, an 8mm film, and film these UFOs and strange things in the sky, which she couldn't see with the naked eye, but she would capture. Exactly the same thing happened to a woman called Dorothy Izzet in 1974, again on an 8mm cine film camera. Certain people have the capabilities of just now and again interacting with this phenomena, but it would seem that they got the trigger. The trigger was to get up, go out, and experience this phenomena. How many people say that? A lot of people report that type of experience, when suddenly they're drawn to look out the window and they will see something. The same thing has happened with myself. But what we do know is that within the UFO phenomena, there is new areas of research that can be applied. Most recently, we were utilizing a specialized meter known as a differential time meter. Now, there are only a handful of these in the world. It's a very specialized piece of equipment which is basically manufactured to order. But what we realized was that in these areas where UFOs have been manifesting, is that there's a possibility that they're saturating the area. There's a residual of a gravitational anomaly in those areas which can be measurable. Now, this piece of equipment has a 100-foot probe and measures the difference between the probe and the unit in any time differential. And we may be getting that microsecond, but even microseconds, it shouldn't really be in existence. And what we can also do is that we can conduct a number of tests regarding lasers, where we pass the laser through the affected anomaly, and we can start to see an arcing in the laser, because the gravitational anomaly even pulls light and starts to pull on the laser line to the degree where it pulls it off its track, it pulls it off its target. These are things that can be carried out in these locations. You know, you mentioned earlier about Skinwalker Ranch. And just like Barry said, the first thing is making sure that we are okay, that the investigators are protected, and basically are listening to their own bodies in regard to the fight or flight. It's a very important thing. And also the fact is that we can conduct new forms of tests in those given areas where these anomalies happen. Because when these things seem to manifest, it would seem that they seem to leave a residue behind. And that's probably around about up to 72 hours. We'd certainly say you would need to be there conducting tests within that time range.
Let me ask you this. Barry, you've dealt with what appear to be sort of evil entities. It maybe is too much of a question to deal with in just a couple of minutes, but you know, we've had a lot of suggestion and argument from folks who believe that people who are abducted, for example, what they consider to be an alien abduction, and maybe it's something else, that they have benefits from it. They get healed, that these are kindly creatures, angelic creatures. Are we talking about the same thing, a different mask, or are we just talking about different individuals, different agendas? How do you reconcile that?
We are pretty much talking about the same thing. It's just a different mask. And this is something that's been going on for centuries. The likes of the fairy traditions, for instance, you know, they it was known that they would take the children and things like that. But there was also a manipulation going on within as the child was being carried in the womb. So these things were all happening, and then they culminated when the person was finally dying. And we see that within our mythology and our folklore. It was a book that I wrote recently in the last few years. It was called Banshee, in which we investigated this particular Celtic form of entity that came and foretold the death. But there was more to it than that. And during the experiences of writing the book, I actually got to experience it myself, and this phenomenon was something which, oh my goodness, it was so exceptionally powerful that it absolutely terrified me to the core. But I should also say as well that it is very, very difficult to differentiate good or bad within this phenomena, because it all has agendas, and it's pulling down, and like all good science, it starts with observation. And today we rarely observe. It all has to happen fast, and that leads us down a very, very slippery path, because we accept the first thing that comes along. During tests within the paranormal world, we were able to see that there was phenomena coming from both ends of the electromagnetic spectrum. And what we tended to have was more of a good experience when things were coming through from the violets into what we can see. But equally, we are closer to the reds. And during the likes of seance work and things like that, you get information pretty fast, but we take it. We take it, the speed is everything nowadays, but we should be aware that we tended to see the aspects of that darker side came through the infrared, through the reds. It was easier for them to reach us than it is for the other side. So we need to be very, very careful of that. And by introducing a red LED into the environment, activity happened much, much faster than before. But it's something that we needed to be aware of, that 9 times out of 10, this did not have a good intention. So it was something that you had to be very, very aware of. However, and we're back to this particular mind connection, the moment that you twig on, the moment that you realize that this is not right, you will see the activity immediately stop. It will not connect again.
We're talking with Barry Fitzgerald and Steve Mira about connections between different types of supernatural, paranormal-type phenomena. In a moment, we're going to ask about who gets targeted and why, and whether or not these guys have developed a master grid that identifies where this activity is most likely to happen.